Father Hardin, a member of the Society of Jesus, is professor of systematic theology at the Bellarmine School of Theology, Loyola University, Chicago, Illinois. He is author of many books and articles published in the United States, Canada, and Europe. His latest book is Christianity in the 20th Century. Father Hardin is a lecturer and consultant to various national, religious, and educational enterprises. He is renowned as a retreat master and spiritual director. Father Hardin.
So far, we have seen and reacted to the first three arguments adduced for delaying the sacrament of confession. Suppose we recapitulate them. First, that pre-adolescents have not yet developed a conscience capable of recognizing moral right and wrong. Second, that the new morality redefines the norm of morality in terms of the individual conscience, since this is presumed to take years and years to cultivate. Only mature adults are capable of sin. And thirdly, that the new morality also redefines sin exclusively in terms of motive or intention and independent of the action or what I have done. Its unique focus is on why I do it. Again, only a mature adult can have clearly conceived motives or intentions. Consequently, no matter what a young person does, let me repeat, no matter what a young person does, it is not morally wrong. We now pick up where we left off to examine the fourth reason given by critics of children's confessions. They say, admitting children to confession induces guilt consciousness. For too long, they argue, the church has been telling people that what they do may be sinful, instead of ignoring the matter and concentrating on the intentions. Until recently, parents and teachers had mistakenly taught the youngsters that certain actions were objectively wrong. They trained the children only too well. Listen to the curious consciences that children have acquired. I quote, what have they done? Pulled the dog's tail, broken a dish, tracked mud on the floor, scuffled with their brothers or the boy down the street. Since they have nothing else to tell, and since confession is for sins, they must be left to think that these outbreaks of childishness are sins. Confession at such an early age may lead the child to see in his childish weakness real sin, and thus insidiously implant the idea of a basic personal unholiness, an abiding difficulty in serving God, which milks the joy out of religion. And instead of the joyful, open attitude of a truly free child of God, an Old Testament mentality of breast beating and soul scraping could develop, unquote. The writers cautiously observe that a mentality of breast beating could develop. Indeed, no human practice in which children are trained is without its risks, as every mother knows. But why settle on early confession as responsible for scrupulosity or soul scraping in adult life? The reason is that sin is being mistaught to people from childhood on. Once you assume that there are objectively bad actions, like stealing, lying, and disobedience to parents, naturally, you will teach the children accordingly. Wise pedagogy does not stop there. It further insists that children be also taught to distinguish between what they may have done thoughtlessly, like a spontaneous untruth, and what they do because they fail to control their selfish emotions, like anger or resentment. All the while, however, this is my reaction, the child is not deprived of access to the ethical wisdom of mankind, not to say of Christianity, which recognizes that habits of virtue are to be cultivated from earliest years and sinful tendencies restrained from the dawn of reason. That's the way, you might say, an old-time Catholic would think. But the new pedagogy thinks differently. Even when its advocates do not bluntly deny any moral consciousness in children, they at least charge that the consciousness of sin went out with making tots accuse themselves as sinners when they were simply being children. My answer is very true. It all depends on how you define sin and sinner. If sin is not the commission of an objectively forbidden act, then no doubt a child that steals or lies or refuses to obey its parents is not committing sin. Logically, though, by this standard, not even adults are sinners when they, quotes, commit adultery, abort, or fornicate. They are simply being human. No theologian seriously claims that even the willful disobedience of a child is to be equated in terms of guilt with a cold hatred of a man of 40. But in both cases, though differing vastly in culpability, sin was committed because in both instances the will of God was contravened. This will of God has been taught by the church as binding on all the faithful, not excluding those whose conscience is just beginning to develop and needs direction in the ways of God. Where this norm is ignored, children are exposed to the ravages of an amoral culture that surrounds them like an atmosphere. When they finally go to confession, I might add, if they ever do, they are not told to relate sins, but rather speak of their attitudes or want of generosity or lack of affection, since these alone are sinful. Everything else is the vestige of an archaic legalism. My fifth area of analysis: the sacrament taken for magic. From this angle, early confession is opposed because, so it's claimed, it encourages the childish penchant for seeing magic where natural forces exist, and conversely, it discourages personal initiative. Generally, the two objections are put together, since they do have a close connection with each other. Anyone who relies on magic will not exert himself in a given enterprise, even the cultivation of good habits. Mechanical chanting, we are told, is rooted in the nature of childhood, since the mentality of little children, that means anyone before adolescence, is magical rather than causal. In their world of make-believe, certain words or actions produce magic effects. Hence, absolution should be postponed until they get over their magical propensities. But as Catholicism reads the Gospels, Christ instituted the sacraments actually to confer the grace they signify, and the Church solemnly teaches this is not magic. In the sacrament of penance, this grace is not only the remission of confessed moral faults, but also the light and strength needed to cope with passion and human weakness, temptations of the evil spirit, and the seduction of bad example. So far from fearing that a child may learn false objectivism, in other words, giving in to its tendency to see magic, Catholic parents and teachers wish to teach children the true objectivism, which is not magical, inherent in the sacraments. They are confident that all, including children, who use confession as the Church directs, will experience the benefits which Christ promised those who receive this channel of grace. The sixth and last objection and area of reflection: the claim that by allowing children to go to confession, you have them neglect human forgiveness. They therefore argue against the practice of sacramental confession before adolescence because it creates a one-sided view of reconciliation. When a person does wrong, so the argument goes, he has first of all and mainly injured other people. He should therefore be trained from childhood to seek pardon from those he has offended, his parents and friends, and not be hindered in the development of this habit by being saddled before adolescence with preoccupation with pardon from God. My reaction. Assuredly, children should be taught to ask pardon of others, and few teachers of religion have overlooked this wise pedagogy. But why exclude on principle the sacramental form of begging forgiveness in favor of the purely humankind, quotes, within the child's own possible experiences, unquote? Why not give the child both kinds of possible experiences? As one reads the bare catechetical manuals, some remarkable discoveries are made, not unlike the redefinition of sin, which we previously saw. There is now a gradual redefining of forgiveness, or what this implies, a new concept of guilt. Judeo-Christianity, which means biblical faith, has always understood sin as fundamentally an offense against God. Filled with mystery, it is a keystone of the faith that God is offended by our misdeeds and that He wants us, indeed, requires of us, to beg for His mercy. On these premises, guilt is first and mainly a state of soul, a changed relationship between creature and the Creator, quite apart from the feeling of regret or shame or even a sense of estrangement that I may or may not have about the sin which I committed. All other forms of guilt are secondary to this one, as all other kinds of forgiveness take their meaning from the paradigm of mercy, which is God's loving acceptance of those who repent for what they had done contrary to His will. We couldn't even talk about apology to others or being forgiven by human beings unless we first knew on faith that God can be offended and that He will forgive. Certainly, this is not to say that we should not learn about divine mercy from human experience, nor that children may not profitably be trained to ask pardon of people whom they have wronged. More than one parable of the gospel builds around this analogy. including the greatest short story of all times, the parable of the prodigal son. But what cannot be said, and yet some are saying, is that asking forgiveness of others is more important for children than having them learn, long before adolescence, of God's forgiveness in His own sacrament of mercy. As I said when I began, I still have an epilogue. I call it an evaluation. It all seems to have happened so suddenly. As late as 1960, few would have dreamed that such complete reversal of policy on the age for first confessions could take place in so short a time. What makes the situation still less intelligible is that nothing in the 16 documents of the Second Vatican Council gave warning of what to expect. One passage in the Constitution on the Liturgy is regularly quoted, and another cited by critics of early confession. The quotation reads, "The rite and formulas for the sacrament of penance are to be revised so that they give more luminous expression to both the nature and effect of the sacrament," unquote, the council. Immediately after this reference, advocates of late confession paraphrase, they never quote, the salutary statement on age in the conciliar document by saying, "Elsewhere, it speaks of adapting the liturgy to the age of the people." Nowhere in the Second Vatican Council is this declared. What the Constitution actually says and urges is that liturgical instruction and active participation be adjusted to the different mental, cultural, and age levels of the faithful. It is just the opposite of not giving instruction or depriving the faithful of sacramental grace because of some preconceived theory which the Church in its highest authority has explicitly declared is invalid and not to be put into practice. Before I close, I would like to share with you my deep conviction that the situation is critical. And it is critical not because of the ideology behind the inversion of the Church's desire for an early reception of the sacraments. The Church does want the young faithful to receive both sacraments of the Eucharist and of reconciliation at the age of discretion. Essentially, the same ideology has been active for centuries. In other words, What is new is not the theory. I might have expanded, I didn't choose to, by showing that the roots of this new theory about the sacraments and morality is Jansenism come back to life in the 20th century. So the theory is about 300 years old. What is critical? What is crucial is the support which the theory is receiving among some bishops and not a few priests who this speaker believes are unaware of the real issues involved. No one should minimize the problem of making the faith intelligible and make it acceptable in the modern world. Children are part of this world and subject to all of its secularist pressures. If teaching them moral values has never been simple, it is becoming more and more difficult today. When the faith calls for ethical norms to be followed, as in preparing a child for confession, this demands such wisdom and ingenuity from parents and teachers as only they can fully appreciate. Add to this the double standard to which a child is exposed long before the age of puberty. A child who asks his mother to buy a gadget advertised on television and who quotes its supposed qualities may be told you cannot believe what you see on television. When he repeats to his parents what a classmate said about a product, they let him know you cannot believe what people say. The child sees pretty much the same thing when it comes to more serious matters. He is told in class and at home about the beauties of family life, and all around him are the shambles of broken homes. Not a single one of our large cities in the United States has a divorce rate under 50%. In school, our country is held up as a model of equal rights before the law. The child also receives reports over and over again how hard it is for parents to raise a normal-sized family on today's wages, and that blacks in our culture do not receive equal rights. If he is taking religious instruction, he learns a lot of phrases about God and stories from the Bible. But he is not too old before he also learns that one should not let religion interfere with making money, and his own parents may be a prime example.
This conference is continued on Side B.